Let's now move on to my second thing, or Teresa's second thing. She calls it the grace of spiritual betrothal. And once again, I'm simply presenting her experience for our interest and contemplation or thought. In 1556, Teresa experienced a deepening of her prayer of union. She writes in Interior Castle, "You'll often have heard that God betroths himself to souls spiritually. Betrothal is a promise of marriage. It's not the marriage experience yet, but it's the promise of it. That's commitment to it. It is a union of love with love. Its operations are entirely pure and so delicate and gentle that there's no way of describing them. But the Lord can make the soul very deeply conscious of them." She also says, "God uses means so delicate that the soul itself doesn't understand them. They proceed from the very depths of the heart. The soul is conscious of having been most delicately wounded, but it cannot say how or by whom. But it is certain that this is a precious experience, and it would be glad if it were never healed of that wound. The Beloved is making it very clear that he is with the soul and seems to be giving it such a clear sign that he's calling it that it cannot doubt the fact. And the call is so penetrating that it cannot fail to hear him." And what they're hearing is a pledge of love from God and a response that engages the two in a lifelong marriage promise. Teresa uses quite a lovely image again. She says that it is as though from the fire enkindled in the brazier which is my God, it is as though a spark leapt forth and so struck my soul that the flaming fire was felt by it. God is imaged by her as in the fire in the centre of her very being, and a spark kind of burned her from the fire, so she's within reach of it. To understand this degree of prayer or this intimacy, it's worth remembering that Teresa herself had to wait 16 years for the final experience, which she calls marriage, spiritual marriage. So she was engaged for 16 years. And in that time, she founded 7 or 8 monasteries all over Spain. She'd written to the emperor, who was a Spaniard, Holy Roman Emperor. She'd been doing this, and she was living a very, very... She was buying properties, of course, to set up, and organizing builders and paying debts and traveling by horse all over Spain. So she was a very, very active woman in these 16 years. So her life was generous, outgoing, organizing, attracting, dealing with the world in a real sense. But we're talking about where her soul was. So in the middle of all that activity, she's got this betrothal. Not just a union now, a few moments of union, but a knowledge that her soul and God are bonded in an eternal promise of love. Father Marie-Eugène writes of this period of prayer, or degree of prayer, "The divine tactic is to cause desire to grow." So all those 16 years, Teresa's heart was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, stretching with desire, as desire does, reaching out, wanting more of this love that she'd tasted. "So the divine tactic is to cause desire to grow in order to increase love and obtain from the soul a more active and intense preparation for perfect union. These desires God fans into a flame by his calling to the soul in which he makes himself felt. and by visits so sudden and fleeting as hardly to be recognized. The painful and delightful wound made by the first encounter, the betrothal, the painful and delightful wound has enlarged. The flame of love leaps forth in great ardor, and the desires for possessing God become keen and living. The divine visitations are intermittent, and they leave long and painful absences. Emptied now of all that is not God, the soul cries out to be filled with God. Not being yet at the summit, the longing can be very painful. Next week I'll spend the whole evening, should you wish to return, on what John of the Cross calls the dark night of the spirit, the pain that can be attached to this final period of purifying longing. Teresa writes, having won such great favours, the soul is so anxious to have complete fruition of the one who has granted these favours that its life becomes sheer, though delectable, torture. It has the keenest longings for death, and so it frequently and tearfully begs God to take it out of this exile. Everything in this life that it sees wearies it. When it finds itself alone, it experiences great relief, but immediately the distress returns, but it hardly knows itself when it is without it. In short, the butterfly, she says, can find no lasting repose. Nothing else satisfies it, and the God who clearly will satisfy it seems to be often absent. And to conclude her presentation, or my presentation of her thoughts on this, very often a desire unexpectedly arises, she says, in a way that I can't explain. And this desire, which in a single moment penetrates to the very depths of the soul, begins to weary it so much that the soul soars upward, far above itself and above all created things. It is a martyrdom, severe but also delectable. For the soul will accept nothing earthly that may be offered it, even though it was a thing which it had been accustomed to enjoy most. And now for your a little bit more relaxing moments, I'm going to read you some poetry from John of the Cross, which is saying much the same thing, but of course in poetry. I'm told the Spanish is superbly beautiful poetry. He's one of the greatest lyric poets of the Spanish language. Translation is just a translation. I'm reading you from stanzas 13 to 21 of his spiritual canticle. And the bride is speaking, the chorus is speaking, and the bridegroom. So it's the soul, the bride, God, and then a kind of comment from the chorus, all intertwined in this dramatic poem. First of all, the bride speaks, withdraw them, beloved. I am taking flight. And the chorus sings, return, dove. The wounded stag is in sight on the hill, cooled by the breeze of your flight. And the bride, my beloved is the mountains and lonely wooded valleys, strange islands, resounding rivers, the whistling of love-stirring breezes, the tranquil night at the time of the rising dawn, silent music, sounding solitude, the supper that refreshes and deepens love. Catch us the foxes, for our vineyard is now in flower, while we fashion a cone of roses, intricate as the pines. and let no one appear on the hill. Be still, deadening the north wind. O south wind, come, you that waken love, breathe through my garden, let its fragrance flow, and the beloved will feed among the flowers. You girls of Judea, while among flowers and roses the amber spreads its perfume, stay away, there on the outskirts. Do not even seek to touch our thresholds. And the bridegroom speaks, I think it's the bridegroom, hide yourself, my love. Turn your face toward the mountains. Do not speak. And the chorus concludes, but look at those companions going with her through strange lands. Swift-winged birds, lions, stags, and leaping roes, mountains, lowlands, and riverbanks, waters, winds, and ardors, watching fears of the night. By the pleasant lyres and the siren's song, I conjure you to cease your anger and do not touch the wall, that the bride may sleep in deeper peace. John of the Cross also wrote a commentary on his poem, rather reluctantly, because you can't do anything with a poem except leave it there. But he did write a commentary, and on one of the stanzas that I've just read you, he has this comment. Describing this experience of being betrothed to God. In that sweet draught of God wherein the soul is immersed in God, it surrenders itself most willingly and with great sweetness to him wholly, desiring to be wholly his and never again to have anything in itself that is alien from him. Inasmuch as God transforms the soul into himself, he makes it to be wholly his and empties it of all that it possessed and that was alien from God. Wherefore the soul is indeed completely given up to God, keeping nothing back. Not only according to its will, but also according to what it does, even as God has given himself freely to the soul. So these two wills are surrendered, satisfied, and given up the one to the other, so that neither shall fail the other, as in the faithfulness and stability of a betrothal. So it's a betrothal, so it's a promise of a joy that is yet to come, but it's assured and faithfully, mutually covenanted. Let me complete my treatment of this by offering another small poem by John of the Cross and a small commentary. In his Living Flame of Love, a four stanza poem, very brief, the third stanza reads, in the more literal, the translation that is more word for word reads, O lamps of fire, in whose splendors the deep caverns of feeling, once obscure and blind, now so strangely exquisite, give forth warmth and light to their beloved. An Australian woman, Carmelite, who's a poet, translated it into rhyming verse. You might prefer this. Though it is, of course, much harder to put poetry into this form. The same Spanish is translated by her, "O lamps of fire bright burning, with splendid brilliance turning deep caverns of my soul to pools of light. Once shadowed, dim, unknowing, now their strange, newfound glowing gives warmth and radiance for my soul's delight." And another, an Australian Carmelite, a man Carmelite, John Vaynard, in his commentary on this, has this to say on that stanza. "The Living Flame, stanza 3, deals with matters so profound that St. John exclaims, 'May God be pleased to grant me his favour here.'" He wants to explain it, but he's begging grace to help him do it. "The soul has become God by participation in him and in his attributes. It's like the air," lovely image this, "it's like the air within the flame." So you've got a flame and all the air around. This is the air inside the flame. "It's like the air within the flame, which is transformed into the flame itself. The spirit moving the soul as the fire moves the air that is enkindled. It's like the overshadowing of the Blessed Virgin Mary by the Holy Spirit. The soul experiences a deep perception and experience of the grandeurs of the wisdom and excellence of God. The caverns or the faculties are wonderfully infused with the splendors of the lamps of fire, the attributes of God. The soul actually participates in these attributes of God. It sees that God really belongs to it by hereditary possession, with the right of ownership as an adopted child of God." And leave the last words to John of the Cross. "All that it does is of God. Its operations are divine, so that he that is joined to God is one spirit with him. Hence it comes to pass that the operations of the soul in union are the divine spirit and are divine."